Have you ever wondered if your company is maximizing the return of your data investment? Are you collecting the right data required to make informed decisions? Is there more that can be learned from our data? Coeus Institute can answer these questions and help you discover the hidden value within your data sets by utilizing a well-rounded approach to data analysis. Stop leaving value behind and start increasing the return on your data investment. The next generation of data analysis has begun. We are pioneers in pattern discovery. We are Coeus Institute.
Hi, Jay. Glad to be
here. Hey.
Do you mind if I just put a very, very quick coffee on for myself?
No problem. I've just done the exact same thing. You go ahead, my friend. What's your favorite kind of coffee? You one of those? Are you quite particular, or are you happy to take what comes?
I drink it black, always. If I go out to a coffee place, I'll usually put some cream in it because I don't trust them. But I make my own coffee black as the night.
I would love to get your thoughts and opinions on the hearing. Obviously, this is a pretty groundbreaking and significant step in this process that we've seen for the last few years. So please take it away, Richard. I really want to know how you feel about it and what your assessment of it is and where it may lead.
I was surprised the hearing happened at all.
Right.
So I guess I'll just say that. Throughout most of the first half of this year, I have to admit, I was very skeptical that anything like that really would happen. I don't think any of us were expecting the testimony of David Grush, or at least not too many people were expecting it. I was very surprised by it when it happened. And obviously that triggered the whole thing, at least it appears to. Once that happened, I thought, wow, are we actually going to have hearings? I mean, you look at it historically, we've had a couple of briefings lately. We've had the Arrow briefings. We had a couple of UAP task force briefings, but not hearings. That's a little different. You know, that's where members of Congress bring witnesses forward to talk before the Congress. And we haven't really had anything like that since 1968. It's a long time. And in fact, those hearings, I think they called it a symposium, but they were basically hearings. They did not compare with what we really just had here. This is a much more powerful bit of testimony. And I have to say, I think most folks have been following the UAP or UFO field for any length of time. The impression that I've had is that most people were very impressed, frankly, by what transpired there, what was said. Everyone was, of course, talking about David Grush, understandably, but let's not forget the statements of David Fravor and Ryan Graves. I had a friend and a colleague who's very, very experienced in this world and this field, who said to me privately, well, you know, they didn't tell you anything that you didn't already know. They didn't say anything actually groundbreaking or new. And I don't think that's really the right way to look at it. I think, you know, the things that Grush had been saying were very much in line with longstanding research on the field. I mean, if you've looked into the UFO subject for any length of time, crash retrievals are definitely on the table. It's been something I've dove into for such a long time, and it's a given to me that phenomenon is real. So here's Grush talking about it. But what I said to my friend was simply, it doesn't matter if they're not telling me anything earth-shaking that I've never heard before. What matters is they said it to members of Congress in session and said it to the world. And that's really important. And, you know, a guy like Grush, again, he was criticized because, I mean, you hear this all the time. Well, he wasn't able actually to give up the information that he's talking about. Everything's about a skiff, and people get annoyed that they can't hear the information. Why can't he tell us if he's supposed to be a whistleblower? But that's not how whistleblowing works anyway. You're a whistleblower, you are enabled to tell your story, but if you have highly classified information, you have to give it to a destination that's able to handle the classified information, that can actually take it.
Exactly. You can't just throw it on the table in a public forum and expect there to be no repercussions for those actions.
I was impressed by Grush's way of handling himself and the way he delivered his information, and particularly, you know, the people who vetted him themselves. I'm not one of them, but I spoke with Leslie Kane about this. Ross Coulthart is also obviously dove deep into this. And it's very obvious and there's been several others who talked to me about Grush too. And he clearly has a lot of influential people supporting him, people who are knowledgeable about this. And I have no reason to think that that's mistaken at all. So I think he's the real thing. And I guess the real question will be, is it going to be possible at all for him or for anybody for that matter to provide that level of classified information to the public? And I don't really know if there's an answer to that at this point. It doesn't seem like there's necessarily a way to do it other than declassifying, going through the procedures, getting maybe a presidential executive order, which I doubt will happen. So we may be at a point where the public is going to be asked to trust the information that's given by Grush. And that will perhaps satisfy some people, and it's certainly not going to satisfy other people. And I don't know how that deadlock is going to break other than Congress maybe bringing forward more whistleblowers, which has been discussed. Whether that will happen, we'll see. And maybe we can see how the cumulative weight of additional testimony, if we get it, will affect the public situation. So it's going to be interesting to see how it works out. I've heard rumors, people wanting to do another hearing. I haven't really heard anything specific that makes me think it's going to happen definitely, but you never know.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's a report expected this month that's been announced. That's coming through Arrow and Kirkpatrick, which after this hearing has gone even, you know, further down in the estimations of a lot of people who were wondering whether or not this was a fully transparent organization or office. I mean, it certainly is starting to seem like there was, and I said this in my kind of coverage of the hearing, was that either this was set up with the intention of downplaying the subject, or it has in some way been infiltrated by that kind of an interest that seems to want to downplay the subject. And the highly contradictory statements from Kirkpatrick in relationship with what Grush claimed in the hearing, which is that he actually gave this guy a classified meeting and spoke to him prior to him taking his position in Arrow. I don't hold a whole lot of optimism for this report. I mean, what's your opinion on Arrow, on Kirkpatrick, on this pending report? How do you feel about them?
I think your first possibility there is the one that I agree with, which is I don't think Arrow was ever genuinely intended to get to the bottom of this. Having said that, I think we can see that there are competing forces going on even there.
So are you saying that Gillibrand and Rubio maybe are not so much on the disclosure side of things as we would like them to be?
I don't know about that. I don't know what they really believe personally. I mean, I've listened to their public statements. They're both and several others have become pretty forthright about at least saying, you know, we need transparency. That's their mantra these days. We need
right.
to know what's going on. And especially with Rubio, listening to a lot of his statements, I think he's genuinely interested in this subject. I can't see how he isn't, and probably the same with Gillibrand. But no, I think what we're dealing with is, I've been saying this for a while, I think we're looking at a factional battle or a war going on. And you've got two fundamental sides here, and that's within the bureaucracy itself. We're not talking about one faction being a bunch of revolutionaries with gasoline and matches. They want to take the system down. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about two factions that are both very establishment. They're both very much part of the ruling class, if we want to put it that way. And I think they basically share those values. But within any elite, you're always going to see differences of opinion, different factions, and different motivations over you know, certain issues. And I just think that's what we've got here. So a guy like Sean Kirkpatrick, head of Arrow, you know, there's a lot of criticism of him in the UFO community. That's not surprising. I mean, to me, he's a guy who just got stuck in a job that's, it's not a fun job, because he's, you know, it's evident they don't have all of the clearances that even a man like Grush has had.
No.
That's one problem. And Arrow, really, it's a DOD creation. And I look at it as the DOD is constantly maneuvering to try to stay on top of this whole situation. I think that's what they've been trying to do for the past 6 years, which is, you know, information, unwelcome information comes out, and they have been dealing with it. And generally, I think they've dealt with it pretty effectively, to be honest with you. you know, the first few years when Lou Elizondo was all in the news. You heard many statements coming from the Pentagon that really, came close to being smears against him. I mean, they went after and really tried to attack his credibility multiple times. I don't think that was a game. I think that that was absolutely what they were trying to do. And they poured as much cold water over what he had to say as possible. Also, folks like Chris Mellon. And there's only so much you can do because the dam was kind of broken a little bit. And or as one person said to me, a little too much toothpaste came out of the tube and they've been trying to get it back in that bottle, but or in that container, but it's really not possible. So there are definitely individuals. I look at someone like Chris Mellon, maybe in the first rank there, who've been just pushing this matter forward within the political class. And he's got allies and they've got enemies. So I think with someone like Fitzpatrick, he's a company man. He's working for the Pentagon. And I suspect he knows what his mandate is. It's not overtly to lie. I don't think that he considers it that way. But I do think he probably sees it necessary to have a very dampened public position on this. So that's, you know, downplaying everything that they've got. And I seriously doubt that he or NASA, which, you know, they're in the game too, are going to produce anything really that's going to be inflammatory toward that. I don't think that they're inclined or going to put anything out there that's going to go against the Pentagon line, which is to minimize this phenomenon as much as possible and to keep it as vague as possible. I mean, even the acronym UAP, think about it.
Yeah.
The original version of that acronym was Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon, which is also much more vague than UFO, Unidentified Flying Object. That's a clear, and which is also less specific than flying saucer. We've gone from the very tangible, visceral flying saucer, you know what that is, to UFO, which is a little bit less exact, a little more generic, you could say, and then to UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, and now we're at UAP, Unidentified Anomalous
Phenomena. Which do you think is the perfect acronym to describe the UFO phenomena?
That's a good question. Well, I'm used to UFO because I think it just has had a lot of public recognition. I think it's usually correct. Usually I think we are talking about objects. The word flying is not always appropriate. These things operate in space. They operate in the oceans. So are they flying there? No, not really. But as a scientific phenomenon, boy, you really got me there. Maybe unidentified anomalous phenomena is good. Or anomalous object, UAO, maybe that's better.
I think it works in different scenarios. Like UAP, like when it's not aerial, but anomalous, unidentified anomalous phenomena. I think that's a fair kind of blanket coverage of all the different potentials here. But then you can get kind of specific. And I think one of the internal ones when it was getting very specific was AAV, right? Advanced Aerospace Vehicle or something along those lines. So, you know, they have their own more specific internal acronyms for this stuff, but it's kind of difficult, right? Because it does, like, different acronyms kind of match up with different scenarios, I guess.
That's a very good point. But the only thing I'll just say here is that I think the current version of UAP as it is has a really effective PR value for the Pentagon. So in other words, to sort of siphon the blood out of the phenomenon itself and make it this nebulous, vague thing.
Right.
I don't think that it is a nebulous, vague thing. I think it's a very specific thing. So I'm not particularly in love with that use of that phrase for that reason. There are elements of sightings that you wonder, is it an object or is it a phenomenon? And I kind of get that. So maybe your point is a good one that, you know, depending, it's in context, depending on what we're looking at, maybe it's
depends on the context. Yeah. What are some of the highlights for you from the hearing? What were some of, because there were some pretty provocative questions. I was actually tipping my hat quite a few times at the Congress folk involved who were asking questions. Mm-hmm. There were some pretty well-educated questions and some interesting answers. So what kind of stuck out for you the most?
When that jumps to mind is what prompted Fitzpatrick's letter not long ago, where
I mean
where...
Kirkpatrick.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Kirkpatrick.
Sorry, just for clarity, just for people.
I just said that several times too.
It's all right. Don't worry. I think everyone, most people knew who you were talking about, bro.
Yeah. No, thank you. But when one of the members of Congress was asking about Arrow's conclusions and saying, well, you know, what you're saying is very much not in line with what we were hearing from Sean Kirkpatrick. And I'm trying to remember exactly, but the question was put pretty straightforward. Like, what, do you think he's telling the truth? Is there, what's wrong here? And Grush said, he didn't use the word lying, but he came damn close to it.
Very close.
Came very close. And I think he said it was, this is untrue or an untruth, something like that. People will correct me in the comments. But I thought that was a very pointed moment, as a matter of fact. The statement that Grush made several times about threats, both to him personally, as well as to other colleagues for coming forward. And, you know, he was suitably vague about the nature of those threats. But this is not anything surprising, frankly, to those who guess, again, who've been studying this. So the fact that he stated that he knew where the craft were, and not only what companies were holding them, but what departments, what divisions within those companies, and specifically where they were. That's a very direct statement to make.
Yeah.
And again, people can criticize it and say, well, what are those locations? But again, that this was not the low, the place for him to give that information out legally. He could have gotten into a tremendous amount of trouble, undoubtedly. So I know there are people who still think maybe he's lying, but that's a pretty big thing to do, to lie that boldly.
That's a bold move. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. Like, some of the specifics, I would love to be a fly on the wall in some of these skiffs that are hopefully happening as we speak and, you know, over the next few weeks and months, because, yeah, I mean, he clearly is confident that he can provide very explicit information about programs, contractors, agencies, affiliations, you know, all of these types of things. And I don't think it's, and I said this as well, I'm sure you've probably highlighted it, it's just not reasonable or rational to expect him to divulge that kind of very specific intelligence in an open hearing publicly. And the whole kind of skeptic thing, which I've noticed, is that a lot of the more popular skeptical commentators have been drumming up this hearing as if it was going to be the tell-all hearing. And I was like, well, I didn't expect it to be a tell-all hearing. And this is just one of the precursors towards getting that high fidelity evidence that we want to see, that we want to get. And if it does come into the public domain, it will be because of these kind of steps, these kind of hearings, and it's going to be a progression. So it's very strange. I just think there's a real weird, kind of debunker bias with this stuff, where they just want to throw a load of cold water over a hearing like this, just because explicit information wasn't divulged. But at the same time, it just doesn't really make sense for that kind of information to be divulged. And these are the steps forward to getting that kind of information, surely, surely.
It wasn't a tell-all, it could never be, but it was a tell-a-lot.
It was a tell-a-lot, a hell of a lot.
Laid a lot out there. And again, in a manner that has never been done ever before the United States Congress. This is a first. There's no previous example of anything like that happening ever, not even close. So, yeah, it was a very, very big thing. You know, back in the late 50s, early 60s, there were attempts to get congressional hearings on UFOs going, and they failed. They, the group NICAP back then had a couple of attempts, got to the almost got to the finish line, and the rug was pulled out from underneath them. And then we had those brief hearings in 68, but none of those compare with what we've seen.
No.
So these are very bold, very direct statements. And I have a feeling, yes, there are going to be skeptics who are just, this is how they're going to be, and this is their opinion. But I think most individuals, I think most people looking at it rationally anyway, are more likely to become very impressed by it. Having said that, there's still been a very muted media response.
I was about to say that. I was literally about to say that.
Yeah, very muted. I mean, some major media has covered it. CNN and Fox both have. I haven't seen anything in the New York Times, unless I've missed something in the last few days, but they
not to my knowledge. No.
Entirely Washington Post ditto. So you've got this factional battle that I keep talking about, I think is playing itself out as well within the mainstream media, which in fact is an arm of that same establishment, obviously. So I think we're seeing the same types of differing opinions and attitudes coming forth throughout much of the major media.
Yeah,
well, but still, well, I'll just say, like, I don't know how it is with you and your friends. Not all of my friends are into the UFO UAP subject. I'm sure the case is the same with you. And I've got a lot of friends that I talk to who are, I think, otherwise very on top of worldly things. They haven't really, this has not gotten into their consciousness. It's really not gotten onto their radar, many people. So there's, I think with the media coverage, it's been very dampened. And again, this speaks to me that you've got the national security apparatus is still doing a very, very efficient job at continuing to manage this narrative.
Yeah, no, the media is incredibly controlled in the UK in relation to this subject as well. You know, my family know about this, you know, through me popping into the family WhatsApp group and saying, hey, look at these, you know, look at these hearings that are happening. And some of my family listen to my interviews, and so they're, you know, interested in it by association. But most people, I mean, if I stop someone on the street, 9 times out of 10, they haven't heard of even like the Tic Tac or the Nimitz, and they have no idea. You know, I said that recently. I was at a pub with my friend, and we were both interested in the subjects. We were talking back and forth about everything. And then just as we were leaving, these two guys who had obviously been sitting close enough to kind of overhear all the weird things we were discussing were like, you know, what are you talking about? Can you just kind of give us an idea of what this is about? And so yeah. You download this whole PowerPoint presentation into their head from 2017 and the New York Times and congressional change. And they're sitting there looking at you like, what? Because they haven't heard any of this, you know? And then you get to this point. And yeah, it's like suddenly you've got this GS-15 guy talking about retrieval and reverse engineering programs. And because the media has been so silent on this, like, it's a pretty significant shock when people see this coverage of the hearing. Because to be fair to the BBC, they did actually do some coverage. It was on the radio. A lot of media platforms did briefly pick it up. But there's been no kind of continuation of interest and, like, you know, additional probing from journalists or anything like that. It's just a story that went out and then it simmered down and the more conventional media has taken over, which I think it's just one of those things where we have to depend more on the grassroots actions, podcasters and researchers. And it's the same, I feel, with the UFO subject in general, is that it's great to have the governmental conversation for the purposes of kind of destigmatizing it for most people, because you can quote a load of serious sounding intelligence agency acronyms and say that they've said this and that and the other. So it does help reduce the stigma. But I think the actual progression of the conversation is going to come from independent platforms like yourself and myself and other podcasters and people out there that are reaching out and doing independent journalism. And then the think tanks and the scientific research and, you know, grassroots funding. I think it's going to be more progress made in that kind of private sector and the public sector than within the government. I just, like you, I think, I don't know if you've changed your opinion on this, but I just don't see them wheeling out the reverse engineered vehicles or anything like this. It just doesn't seem like that's the avenue we're going down.
That's something I never thought would happen anyway.
No,
I don't believe it. To me, when I keep thinking of this issue, sometimes I'll call it the red line of disclosure,
yeah,
which is
exactly, yeah.
The red line being the culpability line. So in other words, an admission that, yes, we've been guilty of lying for generations. That's going to be a really difficult thing for them to do. And, you know, that's going to happen if they do any admission about crash retrievals. And the problem is, like, we are this close to having a near it official admission of it. I mean, the data has gotten out. It's been very, very powerfully presented, and not just by Grush, by the way. You know, there's statements by Dr. Eric Davis over the last couple of years that also were essentially very openly stating, yes, of course we've got them. So, and we know that members of Congress have been briefed on crash retrievals as well by Davis and undoubtedly others. So the real question is, if we get to that point of an admission, let alone just bringing it forward, but an admission that there have been retrievals of genuine UFOs, I'm going to use that phrase, that's going to be a hard thing because, again, we are in an era where no one is supposed to believe in conspiracy theories,
right,
ever again for the rest of all time. Those are bad. No conspiracies ever. And can anyone imagine the president of the United States, for example, saying, well, yeah, the UFO thing, well, that's real, but none of the other conspiracies are. It's not a viable position. for them to be in. So, so it's a real problem. And they, you know, I've speculated, maybe they can do it once they feel that they have absolute, total, lock solid narrative control over the subject, no dissent. And they're closer to that now than maybe they've ever been in some ways. You can look at it that way. And if they ever get to that point where it's complete narrative control and confidence that they've got that narrative control, that maybe we'll see some kind of admission that this has happened, with obviously an explanation that will allow them to save face as much as possible. But even if they do that, it's going to be difficult, because if you let that cat out of the bag, so to speak, that we have exotic acquired technology that does not come from this civilization, the obvious question is begged: who are these other beings? Where do they come from? What do you know about them? How far have you gotten with your research on it? What have you been hiding? I mean, yes, we have an incredibly compliant media, but is it really going to be possible to keep that from being raised more and more pointedly by people? And that's a very difficult position for the establishment to be in, and I just can't see them wanting to do it while they're in the midst of putting through basically a global revolution before our very eyes. I just don't see that as an easy proposition for them. So it's going to be it's the real drama of the next year and perhaps beyond, is where will the crash retrieval or acquisition of ET tech, might be a better way of putting it, where will that issue stand as we move forward, and how, if ever, that will make a genuine breakthrough in the form of an admission by the U.S. government. I think they're the ones that have to be making this, as far as I can see.
I mean, given the fact that we've had this hearing and this kind of language is now on a congressional record. In fact, it's even on that legislation. I've got it because I retweeted it when I was going through Twitter this morning. The UAP Disclosure Act that was passed on the 27th, and part of the language is disclosure of recovered technologies of unknown origin and biological evidence of non-human intelligence, brackets A, exercise of eminent domain. The federal government shall exercise eminent domain over any and all recovered technologies of unknown origin and biological evidence of non-human intelligence that may be controlled by private persons or entities in the interests of the public good. That's provocative language, man. Like, you know, do you think they're going to get far with this? Like, is there a possibility that they could get those kind of statements officially, like you just said?
So it's I think it's still a provision in the bill. I don't think it's been officially signed yet, but let's assume that it will be. And I think in that same provision, they gave 300 days, if I'm not mistaken, for contractors to come forward with that, which if it's passed, if the NDAA is passed when it normally is, I think that would probably put it into September of next year, which, by the way, is right before the U.S. election. Interesting timing there.
Right.
That will play out. But what I would suspect is that the provision will get signed. It'll probably go into law. But what did we think the odds really are that a private contractor, Boeing or Lockheed or Raytheon, are going to say, oh, yeah, well, here's our information. Here it is.
Of course.
I think there's going to be it's not my community. I don't know those people directly. But I have a very difficult time imagining that they're just going to fold up the game and walk away from the table and give everything over.
Yeah. Plus, at a time when America is doing its saber rattling with Russia, does they really want to have the PR problem of arresting and jailing a bunch of defense contractors? Like, you know, the government's not going to want to engage in any sort of major reprimand of these people at such a sensitive time for national security. And I mean, there's so many different factors at play that would stop them from wanting to do kind of, you know, serious action against these
excellent
people.
Point.
Yeah.
Excellent point. Yeah. They won't. So I just have this nagging feeling that this is going to play out potentially. This, you know, I hate to just kill the spirits of the optimists among us here, But I think that this can very easily play out to the advantage of the secrecy group, if we can use that phrase. I'm dusting off an old phrase by Donald Kehoe from the 50s, the secrecy group. I think it's a good phrase, and I like to use it. I think that this could play out to their advantage a couple of ways. One, we have a study by NASA that's going to come out between now and then, presumably. I absolutely do not think that NASA is going to give us anything.
No.
That's going to be useful in this regard. NASA never has. NASA, I'm just going to say it, has never been, publicly speaking, an honest player on the subject of UAP or UFOs, never. And listening to some of the statements of the folks who are involved in that doesn't give me any confidence that's going to change. So there's a NASA study. I think we can probably expect that the provision to get information out of private contractors will not turn up anything for them. So that'll work to their advantage. They'll just say, look, you know, we've looked for it. We've searched and searched, and there just isn't anything there to support these outlandish statements by David Grush, which easily could how this whole thing turns out. And if it does, then where are we? You know, will it be possible? I don't really know. Will it be possible for that secrecy group to be able to maintain the lid on this phenomenon to their satisfaction? It is still possible, even after all this time, all has come out. They're still playing some very good defense and coming in with some offensive plays every now and then. So there's a long way to go before we get that ball down to the other end of the field, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the paper trail could always just lead to nowhere if they hide all of these assets. Then people are going to do the research, they're going to do the investigations, they're going to listen to the what David Grush has to say in the skiff and take the names and the programs, and they're going to go there and there won't be anything there. And then what do you do in that situation when suddenly you have a whistleblower that's given you probably very credible information, but these people ahead of time have been able to sequester and deeply embed these things into their sub programs and compartments and God knows what. I mean, I know that even Ross Coulthart was saying that someone had told him they were trying to sell or like, you know, exchange one of these assets and put them into another contracting group already. And I've had some friends who are within that world say that there's a whole buzz, obviously, just internally from the low levels to the medium to the high about David Grush and about these claims. Like, oh, is this true? Does my own company have this kind of stuff? You know, people talking about this internally. So it's not a closed situation where they can just privately investigate and suddenly catch these people by surprise. This is all being announced ahead of time and giving them enough preparation to I would imagine make these things disappear in a puff of smoke or up into space.
I wonder. Yeah, I mean, Grush, you know, one thing he said is I know exactly where these craft are. So, you know, assume that he is able to give that information in a skiff or in some kind of classified setting to cleared members of Congress. Let's say that happens. Then you wonder, how will they be able to act on that?
Yeah.
Now we heard Tim Burchett, for example, saying, you know, I tried to get access to these and I was denied. So will that continue even after a member of Congress may be cleared to get some information from Grush? Are they going to be cleared to go further and actually visit these facilities or get some kind of, you know, absolute confirmation for themselves? I don't know. I'm not sure how that will work out. And the behind the scenes maneuverability, as we've been discussing here, of these contractors. Yeah, they're scrambling. I think that's very clear. I also heard the statement by Ross Coulthart about to that effect. And we have to assume. It's like scramble. When many years ago, 50 years ago, when Richard Nixon was still president, the MK Ultra stuff was just being the rumblings about this mind control program. And he fired his head of the CIA at the time. This is in late 1972, Richard Helms. Helms knew all about MK Ultra, and he was what he said to his director of that was Sidney Gottlieb. He said, get rid of all evidence of that program, which Gottlieb proceeded to do almost completely. He didn't actually get everything gone, and that's why the program was uncovered more formally shortly after that. But this is what we're seeing. It's like a last minute scramble. Hide the data, hide the evidence, hide the data. So this is the drama that we're looking at right now. And most of it is off limits to folks like us without clearances. We don't know what's going on. We can glean as best as we can. But I think that we're looking at a very significant behind the scenes drama in play right now. And, you know, imagine at some point we're going to get a more full story about it. And but this is a really, really huge, huge development in our field. And I'm as interested as everyone else to see how this is actually going to play out, because it's, in a way, it's like watching a really good football game. And we're in the fourth quarter, and it's the challenging team, which is us, has been beaten for the first three quarters, is knocked around. But we've made a rally in the fourth quarter, and people are starting to wonder, is there a chance? So we'll see. And it's not impossible, by the way, that a breakthrough happens. I do not consider that impossible at all. And in other words, an unwelcome breakthrough of somehow confirmed or leaked information that is just too damning to deny. Is that possible? I think it's entirely possible. And that's just another variable that we need to consider. So this is, it's not a done deal. The secrecy group has a lot of advantages that they have going for them. They dominate the media. They dominate the political class for the most part. They dominate the academic world. They've basically dominated what we might call official culture, you know, the establishment culture. But there are definitely other forces at play. I'll just take this chance once again to reiterate my my view that what we're not seeing is a kind of diversion or false flag attempt by the deep state to divert attention away from other issues. I've heard this many times. I don't think that is the case at all. I think if we were looking at a genuine false flag that was directed as a high level op, whether by CIA or by the military intelligence or whomever, it's been 5-6 years now, basically. And there's certainly no fear in the general public for an alien invasion. That has not happened. I mean, you would think with an actual false flag, one of the key things that, you know, with any of them is you have immediate narrative saturation of the public, whatever it is. And we're not seeing that. You know, we're not seeing this overwhelming talk of threat. I hear people saying all the time, well, they're emphasizing threats. Well, who's emphasizing threats? You've got the old TTSA crowd, essentially, Elizondo, Mellon, Grush. Why? Why are they talking about threats? Well, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that this is a potential threat. That's just the reality, in my view. I think people who say, well, they haven't blown us up, they haven't done an Independence Day scenario, they could have done that, and they haven't, so they're not a threat. I think that's incredibly, very superficial way of looking at it. But also, I think the reason that you hear the phrase threat mentioned when it is mentioned is my take on it. It's good PR for them. You want to get the attention of very complacent members of Congress. You've got to shake them by the shoulders and say, will you please listen? This is serious. This is a potential threat. This, in fact, was exactly what I wrote in my histories of the UFO subject, UFOs in the national security state. I brought up one after another military engagement with these objects. That it's not that the objects came out blasting laser beams, but they were violating sensitive airspace. They were doing things that were not supposed to be allowed. That is a potential threat. If you're a military person, you have to take it as such.
Well, go ahead.
No, that's it. So I think, but where we haven't been seeing talk of threat in any significant way is from the Pentagon itself. I mean, they've mentioned this from time to time, but not, that's never been their main thing. It's always been to downplay, in fact, the extraordinary nature of this phenomenon, to make it seem comprehensible, to make it seem that maybe this is some adversarial technology without, and they've been very, very clever about this, without explicitly pointing the finger at Russia or China, because that would be a huge geopolitical
right.
mistake for them to do so, and it would not be credible.
Yeah,
and the entire diplomatic world would laugh at them, so no one would believe it. So they can't do that, but they can play this little game of indirectly talking about adversarial threats as a potential, but they're not talking about aliens.
No. And I discussed this as well, because I think, like you, I agree that there's a necessary level of kind of political linguistic strategy at play here, where they're using the kind of buzzwords that will obviously activate the mechanisms of bureaucracy and the national security state and the different intelligence groups. And yeah, it makes sense. And we've seen that from 2017 up to now. So we've had a fair few years of this bureaucratic language and potential national security threat. And it is absolutely a potential national security threat if intentions became hostile, because they've demonstrated their capabilities are far beyond our own. So yes, I mean, obviously, if they became hostile, it would be an enormous national security threat for the world, a global security threat, not just American national security. But I think my issue with it is not so much that they're talking about that, because that's necessary, but there's like zero counterbalance. And I discussed that when I was breaking down the hearing, is that whenever they're talking about a threat, or would you be able to defend yourselves, or, you know, is this a national security threat? They say yes, 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 which they should. They should absolutely say that. But I also think that there should be some level of presenting of a counterbalance of how it may not be a threat, or how we should start perhaps trying to have rudimentary communication attempts with these vehicles. You know, I'm not seeing any, it doesn't have to be dressed up as some ET phone home kind of thing, but just saying, like, you know, from a scientific perspective, we should also perhaps be starting to try and signal to these things and develop a level of basic communication. But there's none of that. It's just the kind of militaristic narrative. And so as much as I don't think that's enough for people to be justified in saying this is just a threat narrative being generated, I think there's no counterbalance to that threat narrative. And that's where the problem is for me.
Well, first of all, who's to say we haven't been communicating with them?
Exactly.
And in fact, Grush stated, or at least strongly implied as much in his testimony.
Yeah.
One thing I'll just say in terms of a potential threat that literally no one discusses. I feel like I think I am the only person in our community that comes back over and over to this, is the sheer vast quantity of sightings that happen around the world every single week.
Right.
Now, it's very difficult for us to get an estimate on that. We don't have good statistics on this at all. We have good statistics. Well, we have statistics for North America through MUFON and through the National UFO Reporting Center. Other regions of the world do have some ability to take raw reports from the public, but it's not particularly effective in my view. Certainly there's no question in my mind that this is going on in a very major way around the world. We do get reports from around the world, but there's no good report, or very few good reporting mechanisms from most other parts of the world. I have tried to estimate or guesstimate what I think is going on in terms of the volume of activity. And when I look at the volume of what's happening in North America, my estimate is that we're looking at many thousands of bona fide sightings in North America every year. And North America is, US and Canada, I'm saying here, are essentially 5% of the world's population. There's 95% of the world's population is out there. And am I to think that all of the UAP action is happening over the US and Canada? Cannot believe that for an instant. There's no reason to think that. So I think that we're looking at a very, very heavy blanketing of our globe with these beings, with these craft. Now that leads to the obvious question, is what are they doing? Why are there apparently so many of them? What's their infrastructure like? What's their action all about? They may not be seeking to put us into a cookbook. They may not be seeking to take over the world or do, instigate an open warfare. They may not be doing those things, but they are doing something that seems to be very, very important for them, that, as far as I can see, takes up a significant amount of resources on their part and a significant investment of time and energy and commitment on their part and planning. All of those, I think, are undeniable. And I just don't hear anyone discussing this. This is an important operation that is happening. And I'm not satisfied with a complacent attitude about that, where people saying, well, you know, maybe they're not hostile. Okay, maybe they're not hostile, but they are everywhere. And I, for one, would like to have a clearer understanding of just what they are doing before I'm willing to say everything's fine. There's nothing to worry about. Now, look, you and I and your audience are very well aware that there are many, many cases of sightings and of contact that are not hostile. And in fact, that many people will say seem to be full of goodwill or benevolent. I'm aware of this as well, and I don't deny that. So it's not the case that we're dealing with necessarily every group out there, and I do think there's multiple groups, are intent on doing us harm. But that's not to say that there isn't something that we want to be concerned about. So I think the idea of a potential threat is a valid one. And it's disappointing for me when I hear a lot of folks say, well, that's just playing into the hands of the military. What's more important to me is what is true, rather than what are the motivations or who's it's playing into the hands of. I want to know what is true. And as far as I can see, I could never rule out that this is a genuine potential threat to our world, or at least to human society. So, and you know, human societies, we've got our problems, and we create our problems, and we create problems for this planet of ours. Let's just be real about that. And you could make the case, I'm sure aliens who've come here may be making the case, that those humans are not doing a very good job at stewarding the planet. I could easily imagine that argument happening. And I could easily imagine an intelligent group saying, we've got to do something about them. They've got nukes. They've got, they're wreaking environmental destruction every which way they look. Maybe they're thinking that. I mean, a planet like Earth, you just think about how beautiful our world is. Sure, I have no doubt that there's life, lots of life out there, but is it all of the same amount of abundance? I mean, you look at our world. We have, we are absolutely blessed to have this incredible world that is teeming with life everywhere you look, all over the land, in the air, in the oceans. We are just filled with an incredible variety of life. And I've got to think that any visiting intelligence that comes here, they may likely to be impressed by that. We've got a really good situation here, and one that might be valued by other groups that are out there. I don't think planets like Earth are a dime a dozen. I think we have a very special place. Despite the vastness of our universe, I think we have a uniquely beautiful world, quite possibly.
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder if there's something that had a hand in the development of our species. If we look back on some of the older, more ancient theological stories of the gods coming down from the skies in many depictions and bringing us out of the clay of the earth, so to speak. If there is something that's had that hand in our development, then perhaps at least one element of this, and this is all just spitballing, but you know, perhaps one element of this is the culminating of a sentient species, and that there's this kind of peripheral interaction. We don't directly interact to a point that will change their trajectory. We just kind of maybe prevent them from completely annihilating themselves in this process towards sentience. And then I think about the different disruptive, highly disruptive avenues that are opening up at the same time as the conversation about UFOs, where we're on the borderline of the quantum world with computation. We've got artificial intelligence increasing in sophistication. We've just recently had some pretty significant breakthroughs in room temperature superconductivity. So we're at this very interesting boundary line evolutionary, from an evolutionary perspective, of where we're going to go next. This is the moment that the sci-fi writers would call, you know, the edge before the singularity is going to occur, that this could be the transformation of our species. And if that's true, you know, if we're entering into some sort of next phase of our evolution, and it's this interesting bio-quantum technical matrix, and also our sophisticated models in consciousness and studying the novel effects of consciousness. This is becoming more important now as well. So you've got all of these meeting factors, and UFOs, and I've said this so many times, tie into all of these things, tie into quantum computation and artificial intelligence and consciousness and the strange effects of non-locality. So it feels almost like the UFO subject and the UFO is this shining example of when all of these things meet, you can culminate a technology that can traverse the dimensions of space, time, and the mind. And are we at the edge of that type of evolution? And is that why we're having this acceleration in disclosure and perhaps even an increased amount of these phenomena occurring around the world? Well, I mean, do you think, because it does feel, at least to me and a lot of other people, that we're at the edge of a pretty fundamental transformation if we don't destroy ourselves?
You raise a lot of really very important themes in that last statement of yours. Short answer is yes. I think that's exactly what's happening. So the UFO phenomenon has hit us in a big way, really over the last century, a little bit more when I look at it. And that coincides perfectly with our exponential rise of technological capability. I don't think that's a coincidence. A lot of the earlier writers in the 40s and 50s theorized that they came here because of our possession of nuclear weapons. I think that's a part of it, but that's really not the full story. The full story is the broader technological trajectory that we've been on since we've really discovered how to exploit science in a significant way. And that's the key. I want to go back to something you just said a little earlier, which is the ideas. I think you were hinting at this. Have we been tinkered with in our own?
Yeah. Has there been some manipulation?
I've wondered. I mean, we've probably all wondered this. I've wondered this a lot. And in fact, I did openly make that suggestion in one of my recent books, The Alien Agendas. I talked about this a bit. It's funny. The theory I put out there at that time, it was only 3 years ago. I'm not sure I would say it that way currently. But I'll just say this. A number of years ago, I became really obsessed with trying to understand the best I could the answer to that question. You know, there's a hole in our ancient history, I've always felt. And how can I better understand that? What's the relationship of these other beings to our ancient past? I mean, you got people like Graham Hancock talking about his version of that, lost civilizations. I was asking, is there a reason to think that a non-human intelligence tweaked us in one way or another? You've had folks in Zachariah Sitchin talking this way. And I've been trying to figure it out. And that question, to my surprise, got me. This is something that's really, I didn't expect.
Hang on, Richard, I don't know why, but you suddenly went on mute.
I accidentally muted myself.
Muted yourself. Just take yourself back 5 seconds if you could.
Yeah, so sorry about that.
That's okay.
Well, I just, you know, in order to answer that question, like, is there a hole in our history, our ancient history? I wasn't expecting, but I got really deep into paleoanthropology over the last 5 years, which is basically the study of human origins on an evolutionary basis. And it turns out I have been following that field as closely and carefully as I can. It's absolutely fascinating. And in fact, that field is in its own revolution going on. They're discovering new things all the time. And so I've been asking, how can I understand what these professionals are learning in their field with any kind of ancient holes in our history? And the thing is, the more I look at what they are uncovering, it's harder for me to see just where we would have been genetically tweaked. I am not saying it is impossible. But when I look at the evolution of human consciousness, for example, to my way of looking at it, you know, you look at where human beings were 500,000 years ago, 400,000, 300,000 years ago, the development of spear technology, the development of bows and arrows, and development of rudimentary graphic symbols and this type of thing. it seems to me that it follows a path, and I'm not sure that I'm seeing aliens having tweaked us in that regard. It's possible they have. It's entirely possible that we've been observed. In fact, I think we have been observed by some group over a long period of time. Whether they've been tweaking us or not is another question. I mean, you even look 100,000 years ago, there were multiple types of human species that were living on this planet. Human beings were not the only ones. There were Neanderthals. There were Denisovans. There were the little hobbit people, I think, were still around in Indonesia, Homo florentiensis.
Oh, they're still around in North Wales.
All right. Well, there you go. In other words, there were a variety. There was even the archaic Homo erectus that seems to have survived until a little over 100,000 years ago. We were, in other words, living alongside these other variations of human beings. And so could you see an alien species taking a look at that thinking, they're all doing pretty well, but this Homo sapiens group, they've got a little bit more potential. Let's do something for them. Maybe that happened, maybe 50 to 70,000 years ago. There was a kind of transformation of our consciousness that did seem to take place around that time. So I leave that open. But anyway, to get back, I don't want to get too far off track here. It is something that just fascinates me.
I was going to take you even further off track, because I was going to say, I like the stoned ape hypothesis. I think that is, the stoned ape hypothesis.
Yes, Terence McKenna,
Terence McKenna. I wouldn't say that's the be-all and end-all evolutionary story, but I think that there's a certain level of evidence to suggest that this was one of the initial kind of catalysts for our increase in cognition. I mean, we now know that psilocybin mushrooms create neural genetic effects in the brain, so they kind of rewire the neural sections of the brain and fix things and can create larger communication exchanges across the brain. So an early hominid encountering these, as they would, because these mushrooms grow primarily out of cow manure, so they would have found these as they were scavenging and trying to find food. And a lot of the early cultures, there was a lot of mushroom cults. We know that from the artwork and some of the tools they were using to prepare the mushrooms. So I think that there's at least one signifier of what could have potentially given us a bit of a catalytic boost to our brain. And the other thing that I would say in relation to just quickly when we're talking about this hypothesis is that a lot of these ancient cultures did incorporate geometric patterns and sacred geometry, which is something that if you take enough mushrooms, you're going to see sacred geometry, brother. You're going to see the walls around you start turning into kaleidoscopic mathematical patterns, like you're falling down a Mandelbrot simulation. So, I mean, if you encountered that as an emerging early consciousness and suddenly you're blasted with geometric patterns and strange ideas, I mean, that could have been one of the... could have been one of the initial accelerants.
I think the stoned ape hypothesis by Terence McKenna was a brilliant insight.
Brilliant.
I think he's fundamentally onto something. He was onto something. But as you're right, it's not the be all and end all. No. It isn't the whole story of our emergent consciousness. But I do think that's true, and goes back even before we had Homo sapiens. I think, in fact, his theory was he was going back even 2 million years, if I'm not mistaken. Homo erectus, essentially, which they had our bodies more or less. Their consciousness wasn't, their cognitive capability wasn't quite where ours is. But I do think it's entirely likely that those guys got high, got stoned on magic mushrooms back then. And yes, it had to have affected their consciousness, and it had to have, you know, you could probably have the origins of shamanic culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Happening right out of that, I think, is probably true.
Yeah,
and your other point about the geometry coming through, that would clearly be much, much later, when you get to a point of civilization where human beings were able to construct complex structures like that. Mm. But yeah, actually, why not? That's an really interesting thought. It's probably
it always interests me. Like, you know, high levels of resonance create these geometric structures. If you put like a metal plate with sand on it and you vibrate it to a certain resonance, you'll see the sand change geometrics. So you've got the tone and the resonance. Psychedelics show the same type of geometric patterns. And then physics breaking down into the quantum level, it's geometrics. It's these, you know, these right. geometric forms. So there is certainly what feels to me like almost like the underlying framework of our reality, of our kind of, you know, simulation or however you want to describe it, visually is seen as these complex geometric patterns and structures, you know, whatever that really means, who knows, but it's echoed through psychedelics, physics, and tone and sound and vibration, like Nikola Tesla said about understanding resonance and vibration as the keys to the universe. Sure. Kind of feels that way.
I would want to go even a little bit further than what you just said, which was pretty far out there to begin with. But I think what ended up happening is that we at some point achieved a threshold of consciousness whereby our ancestors were able to, let's say, discover the geometry and mathematics of the universe.
Right.
At a certain level. Like that geometry and mathematics is, I think has always been there.
Yes.
We didn't invent math. We discovered math. We didn't invent geometry. We discovered it. And I think it took a certain amount of time before our species got to that level, but then we did. And then once you get to that level, it's almost like you achieve this breakthrough whereby it becomes like a feedback loop that reinforces itself. And I do think that's the path that we've been on. And from there, you could argue it was only a matter of time before we discover formal mathematics. Once you discover formal mathematics and written language, my personal opinion at this point is once you get to those two achievements, it is literally a matter of time only before you get to where we are right now. And
right,
before we're
right.
Because I think it's like you're discovering essentially the logic of the universe. And once you're able to manipulate, once you understand the logic, you can manipulate your environment much more effectively. And you've got this, then you're off to the race. Then every human society is going to be motivated to maximize that effectiveness, because that's what every human society tries to do. They're always trying to maximize their efficiency, always against each other. I'm going to switch gears just slightly, just very slightly, and bring in the contribution of violence to our intelligence. And I'm just doing this because, as you were saying earlier, we're moving into a new phase of humanity. I've called it the fourth stage of humanity. I've talked about this a bit, and I think that this is absolutely true. So stage one was where we were at for nearly all of our existence, which is hunting and gathering, basically living as the most intelligent animals on the planet, but still living very much in what we would say is a simple, effective, but a simple way of going about our lives. And that was the case for essentially 2 million years. And then only about 10,000 years ago, roughly, we discover agriculture in a big way. We kind of get into that animal domestication and all of that. And we create really our first civilizations, everything from ancient Egypt right on through to the age of science, you know, through the Renaissance and all that. That's all stage two, in my view. Mm. Lots of variations, but it's a fundamentally similar structure of life. We go to stage three with the discovery of advanced science and the application of science through industry, where we've really only been radically exploiting that for the past, let's say, 150 years, maybe 200 years. And now we're moving into the fourth stage, which is it's fundamentally different. It's transhumanism, it's AI, it's all of the future tech that we know about. It's the creation essentially of a digital world of complete data management, digital management, digital control of people, digital organization of societies, 24/7 surveillance, because it'll be necessary from the point of view of managing that stable society to do that. Now, all of that's going to happen. And that's a fundamental transformation of our society. And one of the things that I think it's forcing is a transformation of the human species. And one of the things that is going to be required is a radical diminution of violence and of aggression in particularly of men, because that's, you know, men have testosterone. Men are always much more aggressive than women, more violent. And that's going to be interesting because as I see it, it is violence, first and foremost, which goes hand in hand with the development of our technology and of our intelligence. Our very intelligence comes through violence. It's something we don't really, in my view, pay enough attention to, but I think it's, I would almost say it's at the root. And by that, I simply mean the application of collective organized violence, group violence in the form of warfare, has been probably, I'm going to say this, the single most important catalyst for technological development in our species history. So that removing that, and the violence comes as a result of assertiveness and aggression, which comes out of initiative, which comes out of, frankly, a whole lot of testosterone, which really provide the engine for all of that to happen. And so I wonder what, it's not that human society can't exist without that necessarily, maybe it can, but something else is going to have to drive the management of the species. Maybe we'll stop developing new technologies at some point. Maybe we'll hit a plateau. That's entirely possible, by the way. We tend to think of progress as indefinite, but it may not be that way. But I think we're looking at a major transformation of what we are into something very different. And by the way, something that may be much more amenable to any visiting extraterrestrial or alien intelligence that's here. They may very well be what we are becoming. I often suspect that.
Yeah, I get the sense that we need balance. I'm not one, because, you know, these days just being a man is toxic. It's like this whole toxic masculinity thing. I don't agree with that. I'm proud to be a man. You should be proud to be a woman, whatever it is. And I think that any attack on the character traits of a gender is a bit of a weird one to go down. So I'm not a fan of that, but I do think balance is needed. We do live in a very male dominated society in terms of global strategic kind of movements and how nation states act towards each other. I mean, just look at the posturing between the US, the UK, Russia. I mean, you know, it's all male dominated leadership. And it's embedded
in the DNA.
It's the primate chest beating attitude. That's what it is. Well, I mean, that's what we're seeing.
I mean, I'm not here to defend male violence in any way, but I mean, when you look at the development of human society, you go back hundreds of thousands of years. Of course they were male dominated. Of course they were. You have a small group of human beings. You don't just have other humans to worry about. You've got wild animals to worry about. You've got danger everywhere. And those societies required strong men who knew how to kill animals to be the defenders of those societies. It was absolutely necessary. Yeah. There's no other way around it. And so those societies were male dominated and they evolved. Male patriarchal societies isn't just even a relatively recent thing. It's embedded. It's at the deepest levels of our very being. Now, we're in a form of society now, this what I call the fourth stage of humanity, in which this is a different, all that old aggression. By the way, we're getting a little bit away from aliens, and I'm happy
that's
to
fine.
Get back
like
to
this. I'm not just an aliens guy, Richard. I like to talk about all sorts of things.
Yeah. But we're moving into a society in which that need to defend against wild animals and all of those other things that's not part of our world any longer. And so the amount of aggression that men traditionally have had just by the very nature of their being is an unwelcome development in this new society that is coming out. So because it's when you have, I mean, think of it, you're moving to a society of total digital control of the entire world. Is it really going to work to have a bunch of hyper-aggressive, independently minded men who are like, you know, saying F you to the government, F you to society because they're strong, independent men? No, of course not. That is not going to work. And so I think at bottom, that's actually the fundamental, the biggest factor that is engaged in the transformation of our society and indeed our biology. I think that's going on.
Well, I mean, one example of that is the difference between what people see on TikTok in the West and what they see in China on TikTok. You know, that's because that's one of the apps that's really permeated the younger generational cultures. And it's responsible for a lot of the kind of energy intake of the younger generation. TikTok.
I'm not familiar with the difference.
In the West, I mean, so much of it's just permeated with just, you know, nonsense and stupid videos and just dumb content. But in China, it's scientific, it's educational, it's like, you know, a lot of stuff. So, and this is a Chinese developed app. So there's just little things like that where it's like, yeah, this really does feel like there's a weakening of an entire generational mindset and kind of, you know, hypnotizing people into being stupid.
Ask yourself who's going to be dominating the world in another 20 years. I think it's an open and shut case.
Yeah, well, they've got the long-term game plan strategy, and we don't think in the same way, at least, you know, leadership doesn't think in the same way in terms of long-term strategy. So China is gearing up for, you know, that kind of world domination aspect. And to be honest, the West is deteriorating. I'm seeing a lot of that from Western governments and, you know, the UK and the US and other elements of the Western
West.
The
West is almost a done deal at this point.
It's bad. It's really bad. But this is the thing as well. People forget that we're not outside of history. History is written by the rise and fall of, you know, civilizations and cultures and different types of ways of living. And we're not outside of that. We're still in that. This could very well disappear and be replaced by an entirely different system. And, you know, we're seeing that with the World Economic Forum and with these different groups that want to try and shift different kind of democracies and processes that we would consider as fundamental rights, and they want to move us away from that. And they absolutely do. This isn't a conspiracy theory, and that's what frustrates me, because I know you've talked about this. You've talked about the World Economic Forum, the Great Reset, some of the elements of control and authoritarianism that came around through the pandemic. Like, these are all elements that are absolutely visible if you do your research, and you shouldn't even really have to do your research, because it's just apparent. A lot of it is just quite apparent about our world now. And so it is worrying, and you wonder where it's going. And I do think you're right about there needing to be some level of a shift in mindset. And I would go back to saying that balance is important. To use a spiritual term, the whole divine feminine and divine masculine, you know, these yin and yang elements, the black and white, up and down, there needs to be a balance on the world stage. And I do think that that's important. Mm-hmm. But we're taking it down the wrong route of kind of feminizing men or making everyone have to submit to a type of ideology that would remove the need for any sort of masculine energy. And I think that's the wrong approach. It's not about suppressing this stuff down all the way to the bottom. We just need to find the right balance between our two complementary energies when they're working in tandem, you know, instead of out of equilibrium.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that this is an interesting conversation. I think the feminization of men is not happening because you've got some radical activists out there trying to promote it. I think it's happening because that message is actually welcome to people in the WEF. It's welcome to those people who consider themselves the visionaries of the world that they are creating, which is essentially a technocracy. And so, again, they don't want traditional masculine men in that world. But on the other hand, there's definitely a reaction against that. You've got the entire non-Western world that is pushing back. You have China pushing back. You have Russia pushing back. You have a lot of Africa pushing back. You have a lot of the Muslim world pushing back on it. So it's not really necessarily a done deal that this is going to happen. But the Western model for this, I think it's very clear what they're trying to do. And that'll be another really big drama that we're going to be seeing over the next decade or two, how that's going to work out.
Yeah. So all these elements are in play, including the UFO subject. We're in a very turbulent time, very tumultuous time. And that to me is the biggest signifier that we are in some form of transformative process. I don't know which way it's going to go, but my optimism would like to trust that we're on some form of evolutionary trajectory, that it's not just the end of the world, that there is a process that requires disruption and destruction, just like in our own personal lives, that we go through many filters in our lives where things have to be discarded, or we have to grow up, or we have to let go of a certain type of pain that we've been carrying on to. It's all necessary on an individual and a collective level. And I think that to me has always been pretty provocative evidence that we're heading towards something else, is that, yeah, it kind of feels like things are collapsing and falling apart around us.
We are.
So there must be something we're going towards. You know what I mean?
We definitely are doing it, and you know, I'm an evolutionist. I definitely, you know, when you look through the long history of our species, we clearly have evolved physically, physiologically, and cognitively, and neurologically, and that's never stopped. It didn't just stop once we discovered fire. It didn't just stop once we discovered agriculture. It has continued. So we've been actually on a constant evolution. That doesn't always mean progress, by the way. It doesn't always mean better. It just means you adapt to the new environment that you are now living in. That's all that it means. So on that basis, I'm in no position to bitch and moan that, oh my God, we're changing, we're becoming transhuman. The concern that I have is that the transformation is happening so rapidly.
Right.
It's, I mean, it's of an utter breathtaking speed. We're talking 1 to 2 generations. We're looking at this massive upheaval, this transformation of our world. And I'm not just talking about, you know, male-female issues thing. I'm just talking about the whole thing. I'm talking about
the whole thing,
especially the digital control and the centralized management of, because that's really what we're seeing, a centralized management and control system that's put into place, happening so fast that it's attempting to create a big human anthill. That's happening so fast. Like I could say, well, if in another 10,000 years or maybe 100,000 years, if we were to continue evolving and we get there, okay, fine. Who am I to say, you know, we can't do that? But it's just such a rapid thing. And it's unsettling, you know, to someone who grew up in the before times, which I definitely did. I grew up in the analog world. And so I find myself looking around like, what just happened? Who took the upgrade? I didn't get this upgrade. Everyone else has got it. So it's disconcerting. But hey, the world doesn't really care what I think. It's going to go on and do what it does regardless. And I think, in a sense, you are right that we are moving toward something very new. Whether it's better or not is another question. That's
right,
a value.
Right.
I don't know if I think it's better, but I do think it's happening. 30 years ago, I remember there was the co-founder of Sun Microsystems, Bill Joy is his name. I don't know what he's up to now, but this is in the early 90s, the early days of AI. And he was a big industry leader. And he said, we have got to stop this AI development. This is going to, we are going to have a real problem down the road with this. And even then, I think in the early 90s, people were like, what are you smoking, man? What makes you think that this is even possible? And of course, it wasn't possible. It was never possible to stop that. So we're on this inexorable path, as far as I can see. And it's just like, hang on tight, because this is a wild ride. And to get back to the presence of others, if we can call them that, in our world, I don't think it's an accident.
No.
That they are here in large numbers now. As I said earlier, I think that we can just use a loose term. They've been here a long time. Yeah. When I look back over some of the earlier UFO accounts, I'm a big fan of the book Wonders in the Sky by Jacques Vallée and Chris Hollaback. It's one of my favorite UFO books. I tend to go back to it frequently, and they just go through the long, long history of very well-attested sightings, some better than others, but they did a very nice job at collecting them. And some of those, I think I'm very persuaded, were genuine UAP UFOs. So I think we've been monitored, but I do not believe anywhere near the extent of the last century. So I think something changed. And I just speculate all the time about this, but I wonder, were there sensors in place that detected when humanity reached a certain level, sent a signal back and brought the whole gang here? Is that what happened? That's what, to me, seems like is entirely possible. Because you really, when I look, I'm in the middle of a book project now. I haven't done anything for the last month on it, but I'll get back to it. It's a history of USOs, so underwater UFO phenomenon. And with that phenomenon, when I try to look at the best water-based cases, it's, unlike with aerial phenomena, I think really excellent USO cases start relatively late in our history, as far as, I mean, confirmable ones. I'm talking 18th century, 19th century. There may be some earlier, but they're tough to find. So I think something happened in a big way in our modern era to get someone's attention. And I think explicitly because they must know. I think that there must be a kind of universal progression of how a species that develops higher consciousness and that has the ability to have fingers with graspable hands, you know, that has the ability to manipulate its environment. That combination, you get to that, I think it's an inexorable march to unlocking the keys to the universe. Mm-hmm. And we are now on the fast track to doing that. And I think they know this. And so they're here, well, maybe to monitor this, maybe to guide it, maybe to control it. If they're here to stop it, they're not doing much of a job with that. So, but I think they're here, and it's an important interest of theirs. Because perhaps what we do, we're going to be, it's not going to be long before we're going to be in their turf. And I think it's a mistake to assume that we will never, ever be comparable to their level.
Right.
I don't think of progress as just this infinite progression that goes like this. I think of it as like you jump and then you go to the next plateau and then you jump and you go to the next, maybe a incremental plateau. But I think there are qualitative changes that we've made. That's why I keep thinking we're in this fourth stage of humanity that's happening very quickly.
Yeah.
After we achieve that, who knows? I don't know how far that stage will go. I'm sure it will go much farther than it has, but will it get to a stasis at some point at which we achieve a kind of parity with some of these other extraterrestrial civilizations? I think it's entirely possible.
Yeah, maybe one of the concerns is that as we're edging closer towards the quantum AI evolution, we're still gripping our nuclear-tipped missiles and potentially taking that with us into this new domain. It's like, are they evolved consciously, empathetically, spiritually, whatever you want to call it, enough to handle what they're about to go through? Because right now they're still poised to destroy each other with their weapons of mass destruction. So it's, you know, is this a threshold that we will inevitably cross, laying our weapons down and moving into the sunlight? Or are we just a little bit too tribalistic to deal with the shit that's coming down the road now? And this evolution into this new domain might happen with us taking a bunch of baggage with us. Perhaps that's one of the concerns here from these others, is that look, these monkeys have not learned yet, and they're getting more sophisticated. They're going to become space monkeys pretty soon, and they've got these weapons. You know, I mean, are we ready, you know?
Yeah. I wonder about this.
Are we ready?
You know, these other beings, I don't know how aggressive or not they are. Maybe their physiology makes them less aggressive than us, but that doesn't mean that their society isn't aggressive.
Right.
I think societies, I'm looking at human societies because that's all I can really know for sure. There is an imperative for those societies to have a certain level of aggression historically, because if they haven't, they get wiped out. It's that simple. I mean, you could have a peaceful society that exists for a certain period of time until you run into conquistadors. And by the way, those native people weren't particularly peaceful to begin with, but some of them were. But when you run into another society that's got the ability to coerce you because they want resources, because they need those resources for their use and so forth, they'll just find a way to do it. Aliens may not have the level of aggression that we have, but I would pretty much assume they're used to getting their own way. And I'll also assume that they probably got to where they are, at least in their past, through a lot of aggression. I have to think any advanced alien species at some point became the apex predator of their world. I have a very difficult time imagining how they would have developed advanced tech without having been able to dominate their own planet first. All the other animal and plant species and what have you, I'm sure they figured out their own way to do it. I mean, look, we don't think twice about having dogs and cats for pets. We don't think twice about having little birds in cages. We just do it because we also are used to having our own way.
Right.
You could say that's an act of violence against other creatures or whatever, but I think I would be shocked if extraterrestrial species do not look out for their own interests. They may have learned that having nuclear weapons is a there are better ways of ensuring compliance. I mean, for them, they clearly have an outstanding ability at mental manipulation, cognitive manipulation of human beings. So maybe that's a better weapon. Maybe they don't need nukes for that purpose, but I think they're used to getting their own way. So now perhaps we can say they've learned to be cooperative, but of course we've learned to be cooperative. We just include a lot of aggression and violence in our cooperation. You know, we're cooperative creatures. We're very cooperative creatures, in fact. But we've got a definite edge to us, which has been our driving engine. Mm. It's been the driving force in our success as a species. And so for human beings to lose that, if that's happened, I think that'll happen individually to many of us, but I don't think that's going to happen societally. I think that whatever directing intelligence continues to run human society in the future is going to have a lot of coercion, whether it's openly aggressive or not, maybe not, maybe yes, maybe no, but I think it will have a coercive element to it that'll be overwhelming. And it will, unless the Galactic Federation of Light can come and explain to all human beings all of the advantages of giving up our weapons and just joining the collective. Maybe they'll do that. Unless that happens, I have a very difficult time seeing the governing classes of human society just saying, oh yeah, we're going to get rid of our new AI weaponry that we use to defend. I just don't see that happening.
No. It hasn't happened through the entirety of our history of having a power dynamic in play, a civilization in play. So why would we change that behavior now? Certainly no evidence of that behavior changing. Before we wrap up, I'd love to get your
thoughts. Oh my God, this was fast.
Oh man, well, I mean, we've done an hour and a half. I'm happy to keep going,
what?
Brother.
Come
like
on.
we can keep pushing. I wanted to steer slightly back into the UFO territory and ask you what you think about the DOE, the Department of Energy, and whether or not they'll be implicated in future hearings. How important is the DOE, Richard?
I feel bad that I strayed so far from UFOs.
Don't feel bad. This should, we no, should we stray bit. Everywhere. We, you know, we're both walking through the moonlight together.
We're roaming like wild horses.
That's it.
DOE. Yeah, they're clearly very important in this. I think they're probably one of the leading three U.S. federal agencies that's deeply engaged in this subject, the other two being the DOD and probably the CIA.
Mm.
Well, the DOD, I mean, that's a huge, okay. But CIA for sure. And yeah, I think DOE, Department of Energy, I think has been deeply involved in this. In fact, there's no question they're deeply involved. And they seem to have a lot of protection. And they also, the DOE, from what I've been able to learn, like the Pentagon and like the CIA, have their own bureaucracy of special access programs. This is what I've been led to understand. That being the case, I mean, there is no attention really being focused on them whatsoever. And
there was a question asked in the hearing. I believe they did ask the three witnesses what they thought about the DOE, but there wasn't much said. I think Rush said he could say more in a closed session, but again, he didn't comment much about the DOE.
Sorry, I forgot about that. No, I think I'm glad you brought it up because them and the CIA both need to be brought into this conversation because I think both of those organizations, they're the gateways to knowledge. Do they actually possess the knowledge is another question. Is it, I suspect, you know, the model for secrecy is along the lines of what the Davis-Wilson notes told us several years ago, which is that you have an office within, in this case, in the Pentagon, where the special access programs exist, which are very, very difficult to get access to begin with. And then through those, you're dealing with private contractors. And I suspect the DOE is on a similar model, and I suspect the CIA is on a similar model to that. And you know, we've gotten a glimmer of it through Davis's conversation with Wilson. We have those notes now. We don't have a similar insight or similar expose of those other two departments.
Right.
And I think they're both needed. We really need to be opening that up. But the legal difficulties of getting all of this done, getting this to the people are very tremendous. They're significant. Mm-hmm. And you just have to wonder, I mean, was I talking with you about this or somebody? I can't remember who I talk about what with. But I think this was what we discussed, that Grush, like, how is he going to be able to convey what he actually knows to the general public? How will members of Congress be able to convey classified information to the public if it's not cleared, if it's not declassified, which I don't know how likely that is to happen. I'm going to make a prediction, which we'll revisit this in a little over a year to see how it turns out. But I think that by the time the 300 days are up, by the time, you know, the Schumer amendment's gone into effect with and that includes not just holding the private contractors to account, but also the UAP openness element of it, you know, to declassify UAP information along the lines of the JFK inquiry, as has been said.
Which doesn't hold too much water, since that's still very much in the shadows.
That's exactly right. So and that's an important point to this. So what I'm going to think is very likely is that a little over a year from now, when those 300 days are up, we're going to get a big zero from the contractors. And as far as what is declassified in UAP, I would imagine certain things will be declassified. You know, things were declassified in the late 70s through the original application of Freedom of Information for UFOs. That did not get a lot of media coverage, but it was a very significant amount of information. So if there's a declassification of UAP data this time, I could imagine that there would be some important things that come out. But the question is it going to be enough to move the needle, not in public opinion, but in official circles?
Yeah.
I mean, think about with JFK, the you know, I think it's like 80% of Americans and probably 100% of the rest of the world know that that man was killed in a conspiracy.
Right.
I mean, everyone knows this. And yet, here's the key. And yet, officially speaking, even now, after all this time, the official story is still lone gunman, Oswald acting lone. I mean, it's absurd. It's an insult to our intelligence. So if that is possible, whereas the entire world knows otherwise, and yet the U.S. government maintains a fig leaf over the JFK assassination that covers its hide, can we expect anything different about the UFO UAP subject? I don't think so. I think it's going to develop along similar lines. I think that's the most likely scenario. But wild cards are in effect. And hey, I was surprised once this year by the fact that the hearings happened at all. So they could surprise me. Something can happen that I don't expect. There are public conversations happening. There is a growing, I think it's a growing public skepticism over the government position on this. I think a growing public belief that, yeah, there's something going on with this. This does seem to be real. And that could end up, if we get a whistleblower breakthrough, that could be a very unwelcome development. And I keep wondering, is there something like that that can bring us to the moment of avalanche where you get to that tipping point of data on this subject that just becomes too overwhelming for the establishment to deny? Something big happens. And you cannot rule that out. That is absolutely possible. Some of us were wondering if we were going to get the avalanche back in 2017 when the New York Times and Politico came out with their first articles. Well, that did not happen. We've been looking at this other kind of development ever since. But that doesn't mean an avalanche cannot happen. It is entirely possible that it can. But it would mean that the establishment has lost control of their narrative. And that's where you get to genuinely revolutionary development. If that happens, you're looking at something that I think revolutionary is the right word for it. It brings us into a completely different orientation and perspective on our government and on our world and on ourselves that is going to demand some answers at that point. And that'll be a whole new battle. You know, I've often felt that a genuine disclosure on UFOs, that's not the end of the battle for truth. That's actually just the beginning of the next phase, because you got to assume that the CIA, the DOE, the DOD, and any other groups that are engaged in this, and all the private contractors, they're not just going to, like, you know, walk away from the table and say, okay, yeah, we're going to tell you everything. I cannot ever imagine that happening.
No.
So they're going to fight on this to the bitter end, and they'll play as much defense as they can, as effectively as they can, for as long as possible. And that could be many more years to come. As frustrating as that would be to us, I don't think that's impossible. We'll have to see.
One of the kind of skeptical comments regarding David Grush is his association with, you know, Jay Stratton, Lou Elizondo, Chris Mellon, you know, some of the people who are drumming up a lot of skepticism around him are saying, look, it's all the same people. They're all passing the same stories. His reverse engineering claims are probably just taken from the Eric Davis notes. What do you say about that type of comment, that David Grush is just part of this little small circle of, like, NIDS, ATIP type people, and he's drawing from that, and that's basically the pool of information he's drawing from? Like, do you think that that's true, or do you think that he's got sophisticated sources within the intelligence and contractor world?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly partially true. There's no question about that. But to say they're just part of the same group,
yeah,
really doesn't do justice to it. When you have a very large nucleus of people with significant clearances who genuinely know things, building their own momentum, that's not a trivial development. So that's not where you just say, oh, it's only just rehashing Eric Davis's stories. Since when did Eric Davis become chopped liver? Eric Davis
is a man who
knows a lot of things that are important. And just because neither he nor Grush can come out openly and violate their clearances doesn't mean that they're full of BS. So I think that's a disingenuous argument. But also, I think it seems pretty evident that Grush has other sources. Mm. This is a man with significant clearances. I think we can assume he's been able to get a lot of confirming and corroborating information. And by the way, when he says he knows exactly where these craft are and where they're, you know, who's got them and so forth, I think that, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that goes beyond the TTSA crowd.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that they all knew that. I mean, I've spoken to some of those folks, and, you know, they'll play their cards close to their chest. Yes, it's true, but I don't think that they've actually known all of the details that Grush seems to know. I think he seems to know more. So he's coming from a different place. But yeah, I mean, of course he's going to be, you know, like minds are going to work together on this.
Right.
We're going to communicate, that's to be expected. And that's not a mark against him.
No, that's what I said as well, actually. I've said that a couple of times. It's like, well, who are the people that have been laying the groundwork publicly in terms of, you know, government relationship to this subject? Well, it's Lou, it's Chris, it's Gary, it's these people. It doesn't necessarily, you know, I always found this a weird one, actually, this association of being interested in the subject somehow devalues their input into the subject. It's like, well, if you have a military tactician, you'd want them to be interested in military operations, how things function, how it works. So if you've got good people in government who are either been exposed to the UFO subject in their professional line of work, or just happen to be interested in it, that's not a sin. It's not a sin to be interested in the subject. You want them to be interested.
I became interested because I decided to investigate it.
Right.
I didn't have a preconceived idea one way or the other. I was intrigued. I thought, could this be true? And I wanted to find out. And the more I looked, the more I learned. And I thought, oh, I think this is true. And then this is definitely true. So, and when you learn something like that, yes, of course you're going to become interested. Of course you're going to consider it important. That's a given. And again, I agree with you. That's not a mark against it in the least. But it's, you know, the problem with being especially a public figure in these discussions, which you are and I am and the skeptics are too, is that there's always the danger of falling into the position where you want to justify your public positions that you've taken in the past.
Right.
And so really, it's a very difficult thing to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have consciously tried to fight against that for myself ever since I've been a public person. In other words, I've always tried to force myself to rethink the things that I thought were true.
Right.
And I don't know if I've done it perfectly, but my attitudes about the subject have evolved. They have changed in some important ways over time. So I'm glad for that. And when I would go into a new direction, sometimes I would get pushed back privately from one or a different direction. But I'm glad that I do it. But it's really tough. But to go full on and reverse your position. So imagine you're a UFO skeptic and you're one of the public skeptics.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter who, whether it's Mick West or Michael Shermer or whoever. It doesn't matter. Where you are known as a major skeptic of this, as a rational skeptic. What do you do when you are, if you are confronted with powerful testimony and evidence?
Can you swallow your pride?
How do you deal with that? It's very difficult. Do you just rationalize your position? Mm. I think a lot of it is.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that people will intentionally lie, but I think many of us have the ability to kind of deceive ourselves and
Clever ways to convince yourself that you're still in the right. You know, we're good at that.
And you know, I have to guard against it for myself. I'm not immune to it. I always am trying to be careful about what I think. But when I look at some of these very prominent skeptics, I really wonder how much of this, you know, we all have a tendency to live in our own little intellectual bubbles. And so they've got theirs, we've got ours. And, you know, the best you can do is you try to look at the other side of it. I try always to look at the skeptical side of any UFO case, always try to, and ask myself, is there a conventional way we can explain this? But some of them are just not conventionally explained. No. I just have to say, just not even close.
No.
And so, so that's where we are. You know, where the skeptical positions will be in another year, another 5 years, another 10 years, that's another interesting thing to see how this drama is going to play out. But we are in a major drama here with this subject. Mm. And I listened to alternative geopolitical analysts all the time. A lot of
Me
it
too.
Related to the war going on.
Me too.
Yeah. And sometimes I'll listen to them cast aspersions at the whole UAP hearing, and they'll say, "Wow, just a complete distraction."
Distraction, yeah, yeah. I think there's just such a general distrust in government now that when something like this comes along, people have a very difficult time believing any of it's real. It must be a smokescreen. It must be a distraction. And you do have to convince people actually there is something to this, and you should still be skeptical of the government, and you should definitely still be skeptical of where this is going and the narratives and the agendas that might be at play. But there's a real phenomena. There really is something going on here, and that's worth paying attention to. But I think this is probably a good place to round this up. We've gone through a few different conversational avenues, which I always love doing with you, Richard. Whenever I talk with you, we end up going down some novel routes.
You know, I appreciate what you do, Jay, in your podcast, and the quality of the interviews that you conduct is always just stellar.
Thank you, Richard.
You've got a really good, calm, thoughtful way about you that just brings out, I think you often bring out the best in the people you interview.
That's really nice of you to say.
I'm glad to be able to come back here.
Yeah. Well, you're always welcome.
And I'm sure the comments below will reflect that.
Yeah. Well, people like seeing us get together, man. And I've said this a couple of times. You really did give me a pretty significant boost early on. You know, you had me on for your interview on the Eric Davis notes and everything that was happening at that point. You gave me a shout out. You've always been very supportive of me, Richard. So, no, I hold you in high regard. You're one of the one guys that I still consistently, whenever you drop something, I listen to it. And I have my morning coffee, and I find you a very easy person to listen to in this space as well. So the respect is entirely mutual between us.